bringing out, feel free to fill in on this side if you'd like. Sorry, because of the installation architecture, we have limited space tonight for the program, but hopefully we'll be able to get everyone seated. My name is Redlip, and I'm the executive director of the Drawing Center. If you don't mind, if you have a cell phone on, could you just turn off the ringer now or put it on vibrate so that we don't interrupt the presentation? I am one of the co-curators of Drawing in Its Double. It is a show that I'm extremely proud of. It's a show that I've been working on for now about 2 years with my co-curators, Ginevra Mariani and Antonella Renziti, who work at the ING, the Instituto Nazionale per Grafica. The exhibition really begins for me with the room, the interior room, Paolo Canavari, a contemporary artist who I've known now for about a decade, who invited me in 2008 to write a catalog essay about a project that he had done at the ING, at the print shop, and then invited me to Rome to the opening. I didn't know much about the archive. I've been to Rome many, many times, but had passed by that building hundreds of times, never gone in. And the day after, they said, well, why don't you come back and go downstairs and take a look at some of the plates that we have. I didn't realize the scale and scope of what holdings they had underneath the Trevi Fountain. But once I went down there, it was a very profound experience. There are 24,000 plates that are perfectly organized in an incredible archive. And, you know, they started pulling out, unfortunately we have the screen in front of it, this Gysi, Morandi, Piranesi, and it wasn't just one Piranesi. They said, we have 997 Piranesi plates. We have 93 Morandi plates. And this just went on and on. And what I thought would be about a 10-minute visit turned into about a four-hour visit. I came back to New York, and I have to say that it really stuck in my mind. I wrote to them about 6 months later, and Paul and I had many conversations about trying to organize an exhibition of just plates. So I wrote a letter to the director of the organization saying, the Drawing Center, you may or may not know about us, but this is what we do, and I'd like to just show plates. And she wrote me back and said, well, that's a very interesting idea, but no one's ever asked us just to show the plates, and I'm sure you've made a mistake. You also want to show the prints and the preparatory drawings, because we have many of those as well. And I said, no, actually, just the plates. And silence, nothing for about 6 months. And then I decided that I would write them back again. And I said, listen, I'm going to come to Rome, and let me make an impassioned plea as to why we should do the show. And I did that, and I think I convinced them. And obviously, the fruits of that discussion are here now. This is really a kind of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The archive does lend these materials to exhibitions worldwide, but this is the first time that anyone has ever organized plates spanning about 400 years and only shown the plates as drawings on copper. And I think for us, the intersection for the Drawing Center, I don't want to bore you with too much of the thesis. You could surely take a look at the catalog to understand it better. But the reason why the Drawing Center is doing this exhibition, in my mind, is that it is absolutely clear when you see the plate itself that this is where the drawing occurs. The print, of course, is a record of that, but this is where the creative act of drawing happens, and I think that it's absolutely fascinating because it highlights things that are almost the obverse of our institution's reason to be, which is immediacy and kind of freedom of line. Here we have drawing in reverse. We have a line that has to think about reproducibility and mass production, and I think that there are a lot of issues that kind of unpack from that. Of course, the history of the archive is also quite interesting, and we do have some catalogs that the ING has provided, and you're more than welcome to look at that as well. So that said, it was funny, when I was putting the show together, there was a person named Ken Roberts who I had met, and about 2 years ago I had mentioned to him that I was doing this exhibition, and he said, if you're going to have one person speak when you do this exhibition, you have to bring Andrew. So your name came up about 2 years ago, even before the exhibition was planned, and I'm very, very pleased that Andrew is here tonight to give a presentation. I think that not only will be technically interesting in terms of really understanding the technique of engraving and etching, but also the research that Andrew has done and the work that he's done, I think, with artists at RISD, and probably taught a generation of artists, or at least influenced a generation of artists, to really think about printmaking in their practice. So without further ado, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. I was, of course, very excited to hear about the show from Ken, and really delighted to be asked to participate. And I've been aware of the ING all along, but I've never been to Rome. And so this is an incredible opportunity to see these plates. But one thing that occurs to me is that when I think about the Rhode Island School of Design, which was founded in 1877, the very first accession to our museum was a set of Salvatore Rosa prints from the Calcografia in Rome. So we still have them. They're printed in this weird red ink on this 19th century paper. And actually, one of the plates is here. And I think that's the thing that's really, when you read the story of the ING, it's had so many incarnations over the years since these plates were made and since it became institutionalized. And one thing that's so exciting about this exhibition is I think it's really looking forward, sort of proposing what this kind of a collection could mean for us in the present and what it could mean in the future. And I think that's something that with the Canavari exhibition in conjunction with this, this whole idea of just showing the plates is really so exciting. So I wanted to do three things. So we have a fairly elaborate program this evening. I wanted to start out with showing you a little bit about the technique of engraving. And there's be some things to pass around to for that. And I want to show you some images of prints from the RISI Museum, and then actually images of those prints taken with a microscope and raking light to kind of show how the three-dimensionality of the plate affects the three-dimensionality of the work on paper. And then I'd just like to have some discussion on some of the very important questions that I think the exhibition and the premise of the exhibition brings up. In this whole field of prints that are made from incised metal plates, we're very lucky to have an overriding term for the technique. People don't say it very often because I think there's so many ways you could say it, because you can say intaglio or intaglio or whatever, but it's a really very useful term to sort of think about this discussion. It really refers to hard objects like stones or metal plates in which an image is incised by carving away, by cutting away. And then it also refers to the idea that that incised surface is going to give either a sculptural image or a graphic image, but even a graphic image that has three-dimensional qualities to it from that surface. So in antiquity, when we talk about intaglios, we talk about those amazing carved gems. And so when you see them in museums, they actually are sculpture in negative. Somebody has actually sat, these craftsmen carved away the mold. They actually made the mold by hand on these very, very tiny gems. And fortunately, the curators are nice enough to take those gems and press them in plasticine so we can actually see the 3D version of that. And that's very similar to what happens with intaglio printmaking, in that the plate is made, it's very, very carefully incised, either directly with the burin in engraving or with various kinds of manipulations with acid or also with the surface being roughed up in mezzotint or dry point. And that is used to make a print. The print is both a graphic image, but it also has a very particular dimensionality. And I think that, for me, is a very important link between the plates and what your experience of looking at these three-dimensional objects of the plates is, and how you might imagine the prints to be that come from those plates. So I am making an argument that printmaking is somehow aligned to sculpture. I think of the fact that John Evelyn, when he wrote his book in the 17th century about printmaking, he called it scultura. And that many of these artists, when they signed their plates, said sculpsit, as identifying themselves as the makers of the plates. So I'd like to start out by showing you something of the technique of engraving. Engraving is my specialty, but I think it's also the technique with which this idea of sculpting the plate becomes most evident. Engraving is an ancient metalworking craft. So if you go to the Met and you look at those beautiful Etruscan mirrors, you can actually see the line drawings on the mirrors. Those are done with engraving. You go up to the medieval area and you see those amazing gold liturgical objects, and those are done with engraving. And the engravings you see here were done with the same tools that those metal workers would have used. And many of these engravers, such as Gysi, who made the print back here, were trained as very, very specialized metal workers. So the tool we use for engraving is called a burin. And it's a steel shaft that's been inserted into this kind of mushroom-shaped handle. And if you look at it head-on, most burins actually are square when you look at them head-on. And the burin is sharpened so that we sharpen the two bottom planes by rubbing it against an abrasive stone, and then we sharpen the tip to a 45-degree angle. So this is an American-style burin. It has this little bend in the handle. I have another burin, and we can pass one around. And this burin is actually made for the Swiss watchmaking industry. And so this burin, the burin part, comes out of the wooden handle. And if you look at it straight on, you can see that it's an extended sort of diamond. It's a lozenge-shaped burin. And that makes a different kind of a line. It makes a line that's both finer and deeper. We can pass that around too. Now the metal that we use for pictorial engraving is copper. And one of the interesting things that we can't see on the plates that are on view today is the fact that the backs of the plates have kind of hammer marks. So one of the very important crafts of the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th century was the craft of being a coppersmith, taking an ingot of copper, hammering it out, flattening it, and making it ready for the engraver. And so we can look at these plates and really think a good deal of labor went into them before they even became available to the printers. Our contemporary copper is actually rolled in a mill. And it has a very pronounced texture in one direction. So the older copper had a much more kind of even molecular grain, and it was a little bit harder. Now, you do see some of the old plates here are silver, and that's there's this silver color, and that's because they've been electroplated. So they've been given a very, very thin layer of steel or chrome, and that makes them more durable to the kinds of wiping that manipulations that the plates undergo in printing. But I was really rather glad to see that so many of the plates here still have that freshness of the original copper. Many of the newer plates that we see here are made of zinc. So zinc is a softer metal, and I think really allowed for some of the extreme manipulations we see in these prints, like the inlaid print at the end and that remarkable shaped plate. That's on the back wall there. So the engraver works on the plate, and usually the design will be put onto the plate with a steel tool that's called a dry point tool or an etching needle, and the design is just scratched into the plate. And oftentimes in very early impressions of prints that were done perhaps in the first 100 of the run, you can actually see those very, very lightly scratched lines. We call them dry point lines. And that's really a kind of guide for the engraver. But usually the engravers did not plan out every single line. There was a kind of improvisation that happened within the outlines as they created their shading. And in many cases, the preparatory drawings for engravings are actually done in kind of continuous tone or wash. So one of the kind of interpretive acts of the engraver is to decide what kind of cross-hatching will be best for the print. Now, engraving is a very strange way to make marks on a plate or make any kind of marks. To do curves, the plate is placed on this sand-filled leather pad. And that allows a kind of pivoting action to the plate. So I'm left-handed, And so if I want to make a curve, I engage the tool in the plate, and with my right hand, I actually push the plate into the tool. Now, as I'm pushing, there's this little curl of copper emerging from the plate, and we call that the burr. And so when I get to the end of the line, so I'll pass one of these around with the burr on it, but when I get to the end of the line, the burr is sitting there. And I clip it off with this tool that's called a scraper. So that gives me a line that has a pointed end. It goes through the curve and swells a little bit. And at the very end of the line, it comes to this blunt termination, this perpendicular termination. So when you look closely at the prints, especially the engravings, you can really see where the artist entered the line and where the artist terminated the line. And one of the very, I think, very interesting things by looking at the plate, that we get from looking at the plates, is we can see that even more clearly than sometimes we can see it in the actual prints themselves. In addition to curves, you also will see many kind of dots on the prints. So the artist can kind of flick onto the plate and create stippling. And I think some of people in the audience were already asking me about the straight lines, the kind of ruled hatching. And that's created by using a scriber to inscribe the line onto the plate, and then holding the plate flat on the table, and then following the line with the burin. So when you look at the plate, you can actually see that there's this little piece of curl of copper that's been displaced there. So when we think about the whole idea of intaglio printmaking, and especially with engraving, you can see how close it is to this whole idea of kind of carving away. And the great advantage of engraving is that it allows the artist to really control the width of the line in relation to the depth of the line. So that when I'm sitting there with my magnifiers, I can really see exactly how deep I'm going and exactly how wide the line is going to be. The other thing that can be controlled are the terminations. And then the engraver can also go back into the lines to make them wider. So in some ways, when I show my students how to engrave, the demonstration usually takes about 20 minutes. But then the practice period can take many, many years. And so it's one of those things, it's not a complicated or difficult thing to do, but it's something that is very, very much about practicing. So if any of you would like to try it, when we were showing around the, when you have some time after the talk, please let me know. Now I'm going to move on to some of the images, but as the images are on, I want you to think about, I want you to do something that you're never supposed to do, and that's to touch some prints. Because if the whole idea is that the plate itself is a kind of mold, and that the paper gets pressed into the mold, and that the ink itself and the paper ends up with this kind of pronounced texture that's a result of the plate, then it's actually a very tactile thing. Now, we don't go into museums and touch prints, but I took these proofs, and I mounted them, and I invite you to touch them and to really feel the kind of sense of relief on the prints. And there's also a plate that goes with this print that you can pass around as well. Now, I wanted to show a few images of engravings that I've really enjoyed over the years, and I could have shown 130, but I decided to just keep it down to 13. And I didn't actually show impressions of prints that are or plates that are in the exhibition, but I thought that some of the points that I make can certainly apply to prints that are in the exhibition. And I wanted to show 500 years of prints. So the most recent print is this engraving by James Sienna from 2005. And the earliest print is by Albrecht Dürer from 1505. And I thought we'll go backwards. It's nice to end with Dürer, I think. But I've always enjoyed this print by James Sienna, but never more so than when I saw his work at the Whitney Biennial. Not only was his work the only prints, but they were the only engravings, of course, and it was an incredible moment of affirmation. And this print shows how he used these straight engraved lines in these kinds of bursting clusters. And so at RISD, we actually have a microscope that we can use to look at works on paper very, very closely. And so I wanted to see if by looking at these in raking light, that we could actually start to see how this kind of puffiness of the ink, you can actually see that the ink stands out and then casts a shadow onto the paper. So there's this very strong sense of relief in this. But also, we can really see, and I think as you look at all the prints, you'll actually see that there's a very characteristic hand to each artist working on engraving. So here we have these remarkable sort of straight lines, and we really do see how he entered the plate, and then how in some cases, you can see that's an entrance. Some of these are flicked out terminations, and how he sort of, the viewer sort of gathered, and he may have gone back in to heighten some of the terminations. And we can also see certain slip strokes, like places where he went a little bit too far and then had to correct with the burnisher to kind of flatten things out. But he did leave those lines in. But I think a very remarkable mastering. This was printed by Harlan the Weaver, and a beautiful sort of soft printing that they did with a bit of Sheen Kalei for that one. One of the great things about the exhibition, I think, is that it lets us know about certain Italian artists that we may never have heard about in the U.S. In the period after Morandi. And there are artists I'm really excited about knowing more about. But I also thought I would show some artists from America and France who were from a similar period and working with Stanley William Hayter had a similar kind of experimental attitude. And this is Anne Ryan. It's her print, we call it Hunter-Huntress. And it's from 1945, when she was working with Hayter. And he was somebody who really encouraged artists to try out engraving. I mean, I think one of the differences between this Italian group and the artists who work with Hayter is that engraving was a kind of centerpiece for artists working here in the US. And so it's really remarkable, I think, to see the details in the Anne Ryan, because she was not going for that kind of professional smoothness in her work. You can actually see the kind of struggle, these very, very slow lines that she picked up and went in again to make her curves. And then we also can see this kind of hand printing. So here we have this place where the ink didn't quite get into the line, but I think it also makes it quite clear how the paper was sort of puffed forward there, that it actually has conformed to the shape of the line in very slight relief. And I think that's even more clear in this detail, where we actually have the highlights on the ink in this one, and also the areas where the ink didn't take, and we can really see how the paper has become molded, become a positive for that carved out negative. This is a print by another artist who worked a great deal with Stanley William Hayter Roger Vieillard. So this was when Hayter was in France, and Vieillard was working with this kind of amazing surrealist imagery. This is his Prometheus from 1940. And he was a very accomplished engraver who developed, I think, a very almost this incredibly vigorous style of pushing the tool and flicking out to create these knife-like planes with his work. And then this really remarkable figure that with these very, very thick strokes where he worked the plate again and again, done in pure engraving. Now these turned out to be a little bit squished. I wonder what we should. Okay, well,
so you'll have to.
Okay. This is a print by Jean-Emile Laboureur. And people, when they think of engraving the 20th century, think it was all Stanley William Hayter. But there were other artists who were working with engraving and kind of revitalizing the technique. And this is his print from 1932 of The Entomologist. So I always think of Laboureur as this kind of great Art Deco artist. We could imagine this being an amazing tapestry or amazing textile type of thing. But it's also great to look at his details. So here we have, if you look at this, you can see this is that leaf. It's a big print too. And that's the little dragonfly. And here we see that the dragonfly is barely on the page, but then very lightly engraved. But then this kind of very bold, even curved line is quite characteristic of Laboureur. And I think that it's his curves that are very different from Anne Ryan's curves or from those very, very knife-like marks of Vieillard. And here's another area of the foliage. This is a British print from 1935. It's an engraving by a British engraver, Stanley Anderson, called Good Companions. And Anderson did this amazing sort of regular outlining and this very, very kind of regular hatching. And we can just start to see in some of the darks where that hatching and ink creates this sense of relief, but he was very even with his depth. Sort of a very disciplined artist, seeming to almost come out of a kind of banknote sort of tradition. Now here's a face you'll never forget. It's a print from 1887 by a French engraver named Ferdinand Gaillard. And I really consider him, and certainly Stephen Van has written a great deal about him, he was kind of the last major artist of the great French academic engraving tradition. He did a lot of portraits of clerics, and this is his most famous work, this kind of religious fanatic look here. It's a rather small print. I would say it's 5 by 7 inches. And here we actually see the detail of the eye, which you really couldn't see. He has this amazing sense of continuous tone, but it's all done with urine work. So the tool that I used is the tool that was used to flick out all of these lines. And he was trying to create a combination between the regularity of the older reproductive engraving and a kind of greater softness that we might associate with etching. And when we look at proof states of this print, and I think it would be very interesting to see the plate for this print, we can actually see that he actually removed a great deal of material. He worked as much with building up as he did with taking away. And here's a detail of the mouth. And I think that really, it's an amazing combination of regular, because you see the thicks and the thins, the thick and the thin, and then this kind of overall lines between the lines and hatching to kind of soften things. This print is a little wider. It's a truly remarkable work by an Italian engraver named Agostino Lauro. This print is about 8 inches tall, so it's a small print, and it's from 1845, which blows me away because photography
was barely existed. I mean, he may have seen a couple of daguerreotypes, but you can see how it already influenced his vision so much. And he lived in Turin. He did a lot of banknote work, and this plate still exists in Turin. One of the stories about the print is it actually hung in John Everett Millais' studio. So early Pre-Raphaelite knew this print before Pre-Raphaelitism was a thing. But the other thing that I think is incredibly remarkable about it is that it's this tribute. I think it's called The Meditation, and it's a portrait of the artist's daughter, but it's an amazing tribute to Dürer's Melancholia in this kind of Italian Biedermeier setting. Here's a detail of her face. And so we're talking about a very, very tiny thing. And it's made up with a combination of Buren engraving, etching, and then very, very light dry print. So it's an ineffable web, I think, of marks that create this kind of spumato effect in the face. And I have a detail of the dog. Where we really just see the tiniest dry point lines here, we see these kinds of etched areas here, and then the very faintest, some very, very delicate engraved hatching. And we have this impression of Italy that somebody gave us in 1913, but I've never seen it anywhere else. So, certainly one of the most striking people in engraving history is William Blake. And his last major masterpiece was the Book of Job from 1826. And when Blake did the Book of Job, he was making a major statement, because most people, you know, lithography was really coming into its own. Most people were working in kind of mixed methods, like Lauro, using etching, engraving, and dry point to make plates. But Blake said, I'm doing it just in engraving. I mean, it's a really statement about being attached to the old way of doing things. And I have a detail from one of his prints from Job, not the one we just saw. No matter how much he was trying to do the old masters, it was always blank, right? So, incredible kind of line work with the Buren. And you can really start to see the highlights on the edges of the ink and his willingness to really build up the lines into those deep blacks. And Blake's plates for the Book of Job still exist. So they're in the British Museum, and quite a few of Blake's prints still exist, plates still exist. And a book just recently came out about them. By Mei Ying Sung. And she actually examined all of the plates and looked at the backs of the plates. And one of the things that she found is that every time Blake made a correction, he hammered the plate back up so the surface would be flat again. And so she was able to really figure out a great many of the kinds of corrections that Blake made. And she was also able to compare Blake's plates with other British plates from that time. And what it really showed is that Blake was so free as an engraver that if he didn't like something, he was perfectly willing to scrape it out and hammer it up and do it again. It was this, really it revealed something about his process that I think was very important, and something that's similar to what we can learn from looking at these plates. Here we have a cloven hoof from one of the torches of Job, and then these amazing marks here. And then, most remarkably, one of the images from the margins, which, the Book of Job prints are about 6 by 8 inches, so they're really rather small plates, and these tiny figures, when you blow them up, have an incredible freedom, and we also do see some of his little dry point sketching and that sort of thing. Now, if we want to think about the antithesis of Blake, it would be a great reproductive engraver like Weil. He was a German who was really the most dominant influence in 18th century in France engraving. And certainly when we look at the remarkable print after Canova, or that print after Correggio, we really see this kind of incredible smoothness that we associate with veal. And this print is from the 1780s. It's the death of Mark Antony after Pompeo Batone. But it's really when you get close to it that you have to wonder if a human did it. So here's Cleopatra's earring. And here we actually see this incredible system that he created for describing the skin. So we not only have this cross-hatching, but then we have the lines that sort of go inside that cross-hatching. If you notice, his terminations are incredibly worked out. He actually went this way and this way in order to make those lines so they had that particular termination within this. And that's in this tiny area here, you know? Even more remarkable is this detail from Mark Antony's drapery, where we can actually see the height of the ink, the kind of sculptural quality of the marks, and then we can actually see how he created this web that, and then contrasted the lines between the lines with this section that's just the solid lines. All these things trying to create, I think, equivalencies for the colors of the actual painting. Now, looking at veal and seeing this sort of superhuman, I would say, perfection, it's very interesting to go to an artist like Nontoy. And veal built his style out of Nontoy, but with a very different feeling. And I have a big print by Nontoy in my studio, and I just put on my magnifiers every now and then and look at it. And even though it's so perfect, there's a certain warmth to it. And that's what I really do see in this detail from the Nontoy drapery, the kind of warmth to these lines, the kind of invention. There's a difference to it, to these lines. And once again, really, we do see the kind of height as those lines stick up on the page. But the most remarkable thing about Nontoy, this is a place where the forehead goes into the hair, and it is really this whole art of transitions. And that's the great mystery for me, how he gets from these little tadpoles to the first layers of hatching, and then how he gets into the darker darks, and then how suddenly that all becomes hair. It's pretty astounding in his work. And then when we look at that print and think that it's from the 1660s, people must have been blown away by how vivid this was as an image. I think more vivid than any painting could have been. This is my personal great hero, Claude Melun. It's The Death of Adonis from the 1630s. Melun is an artist who worked very much with his style without cross-hatching. And this is a transitional piece. It's about 10 by 12 inches. And so we can see that he has some cross-hatching in it, but that he was also experimenting with areas where the form was developed without cross-hatching, without contours. And when we get close to his line, we see a line of great vigor and vitality. And this is an impression of the print that really has a lot of height left to the ink, because I think we can even start to distinguish the shallow lines from the deeper lines. And the other thing we can really see with Claude Melun is how he re-entered the line. So we can see that this line gets fatter in this direction. It kind of slows down here because he re-entered it. Here, he re-entered the line and flicked out on this side. And here we can actually see how he built up the lines by entering them maybe two or three times. So, you know, by this kind of close looking, we can really get a feeling for the three-dimensional qualities of that print as an object. And that's another detail. In the exhibition, there's a print by Marc Antonio Raimondi, and this is a print by Marc Antonio after Raphael, St. Paul preaching. And with Marc Antonio, in a print from this time, he tended to print with very oily ink. And so there's much less height to the ink, but there's also a kind of crumbly nature to the lines. Marc Antonio was an artist who really introduced a kind of regularity into cross-hatching. But we can always recognize his hand because he was never that perfect in mining his lines. There's better that mechanical quality to his work. There's a kind of improvisational quality that is particularly his and very different from copyists who worked after him. And we end with the Small Horse by Dürer from 1505. And if we look at this area with the helmet, we can actually see the man's face there. But Dürer's ink was very dark and really does have a certain amount of height to it. And so you can actually start to see the highlights on those ink lines here. And even in this area in the horse, you can actually start to see the lines in depth standing over one another and sort of creating this rather textured area. I mean, it's a very tiny print, and we're looking at it under a microscope, but we really are starting to see just that kind of great texture and really seeing his beginning the lines and flicking out for the terminations. So I'd just like to end by considering some of the questions that this exhibition brings up. Because I think that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to take the time to talk about it. One thing that I do find very provocative is the title. This whole idea of drawing and its double. Well, you know, when we look at the prints of the exhibition all the way up to Morandi, we can assume that there actually was a very elaborate drawing for most of these prints. In some cases, the drawing was by the artist who made the prints, so the drawings of Pietro Testa or Salvatore Rosa are certainly fairly free and improvisational in some ways. But then if we think about the drawings that are after paintings or sculptors, the engravers didn't stand in front of the painting or sculpture. They didn't have access to it for the full time they were making that work. There was a very finished copy drawing, sometimes a copy drawing that could take months just to make the drawing that's in the background for each one of these prints. So when we think about the prints themselves, or the plates, they're already distanced from the drawing in a certain way. And the graphic image is really a translation of the original drawing and the original work. The thing that I think the graphic image also is, though, is that it's actually in some ways an index of the sculptural qualities of the print, because it's of the plate itself. You know, the plate itself has this incised depth, and then that incised depth is transferred to the piece of paper itself. So I think that it's really very, it's very interesting to think about the whole idea of whether the work we do on the plate actually is drawing. I don't know, for me, maybe it isn't.
I think it's drawing. It's a new drawing. It's a new original. It just is.
I sometimes, for engraving, I wonder if it actually is, but the thing I think, though, is when we think about the intaglio, maybe it is a little bit more like sculpture. Like it is a sculpture that we make on that plate that then becomes the graphic image. It's hard, I think it's something to think about. And I certainly know that's the way I feel when I'm making my own plate. So I brought a plate. And So, you know, when I work on a plate like this, it'll take me maybe 4 months to make it. And it's this kind of incredibly intense object that I work on for all this time, carving it away, kind of living in this space, and it's almost experiencing it as a hologram. It has this unbelievable three-dimensional reality to it when I make it.
You also used to make three-dimensional tablets.
I do, make sculptural models for my... And I guess that's the next question. It brings me to this whole next question that I think the show brings up in a very exciting and interesting way. And that's this question of whether the plate is actually a work of art. You know, what is the status of the matrix as an art object? And that's why I just think Paolo's exhibition is incredible, because I think it's a place where it's very convincing that the plate is an art object. It's not just a piece of decorated metalwork. And I think the decisions that he made in presenting those plates are so significant. The fact that they have that shiny steel-faced surface, the fact that they are slightly convex in the way that they're mounted, their scale, the way he used the ink on them, all those things in this wonderful way that we can see ourselves through those smoke images, or we can see the room in that image with the figure and the object. I think it's an incredible way of thinking about the idea of the plate as an art object. At Filigrafica, and certainly many artists who do woodcut are interested in putting forth the woodcut as an art object. And I saw that this amazing thing at Filigrafica in Philadelphia last year at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, and it was that Tromorama video, which was not made from the woodcut prints, it was made from the blocks. And it was an exhilarating thing to see, and I think a very challenging way that the matrix becomes the work of art. And I actually have to say that one of my graduate students, Ivrizdi, approached me in January and said, "Okay, Andrew, can you teach me engraving?" And I had no idea what he's going to do with it. And he started to figured out how to make actual holograms on the plate. So that he makes the configuration, the center of the plate, and then he takes a compass, and at various points, he creates these circles all around that overlap. And then he engraves those circles, and then when you hold it to a point of light, that image actually appears in the circles. And he prints them, but then the plate is an art object. So I think it's a question that's out there. And I think this show helps us to ask that question as artists, like what's the status of the print, the plate as an art object? For me, I'm sure that as involved as I am with these plates, and as much as I love them, they are not the art object. That's something, it's the graphic image. You know, the impression from the print that is the ultimate art object. But I think it's a question for all of us. The other question I have is, what do we learn by looking at the plates? You know, what is it it's giving us that we couldn't get by looking at a very detailed series of states? Somehow if we look at proof impressions that were made along the way of developing the plate, what is the particular thing that we can get out of seeing the plate? And certainly, as Mei Yung Sung tells us, you know, this whole idea of the corrections become extremely obvious and even very poignant when we look at certain plates. For instance, and I think not that it's a correction, but that one plate over there with the inlaid zinc, I think that that's something that's much clearer to us when we see it on the plate itself than it may have been in the actual impression. And when you have a chance to look at my plate, you can actually see areas where I've scraped out in an attempt to make corrections or lighten areas And those are little kind of bumps and indentations in the plate. The other thing I find as an artist looking at these plates is, even though the impressions of these prints that I might know sometimes seem incredibly perfect, I actually do see a certain roughness or hand of the artist when I look at the actual engraved marks. All of us are just wild to see the Piranesi plates, because we've always wondered how he could get such dark darks and etching without wiping out the ink. And when you look at them, it's quite clear that he put lines into the lines to create those big, big, wide lines. That's an amazing thing to see. I know that Angela Campbell here is actually, I think, considering the whole idea of the site of production and of the plate, but in some ways by looking at what happens to a plate over a course of time in her work with the Dürer Meisterstück. So to see from the existing impressions, we don't have those plates anymore, but to see from the existing impressions how they changed, what scratches emerged and went away, to sort of think about what went on over the course of the life of the plate, it's definitely a question that I think is out there in art history that we're going to see more about as we sort of think about what, and I think these objects are an incredible resource for that. And the last question I have is, what's going to happen to today's matrices? I mean, what's going to happen to all those prints from Crown Point Press or Harlan and Weaver? What's going to happen to all the plates from Two Palms? What's going to happen to all of these artists who are independent printmakers like myself who have piles of plates? And I think it's a huge question. You know, the people who put this collection together didn't know how valuable it was going to be, you know, 150 years from the time when somebody decided to put it together. And I really wonder how valuable it could be 150 years from now, 200 years, 50 years from now, to have those plates, to have that James Siena plate around, you know, in the kind of storage conditions, in the kind of conditions where it could be studied. And it's also a very difficult thing with independent artists. Some artists are lucky, like Reginald Marsh, his widow and the Whitney Museum were able to publish some of his prints. Some artists like Peter Grippy, there was so much that could have been done. I know his plates have gone to a museum, but you know, maybe they could have been printed more. I mean, there's just a lot of questions out there about that, but I do wonder, like, what sort of institution in the U.S. would really be able to take on this role and create the, considering what's happened in the last 40 years of printmaking in the United States, to take on the role to create a calcographia for us. So I'd love to answer any questions, especially as we look around the prints. I did bring extra optivisors for people who want to take a close look. And I'm just, thank you for inviting me. It's been so nice to be here.
So we're going to be open for another half hour or so. Why don't we just make it informal? If you want to ask me some questions, maybe we should just do that kind of as we're walking around. And I think looking at the plates might be the best way to engage. So thanks so much for coming.